to kind of look. Mount Joy, you're beautiful. This is my first time back in this building on a Sunday morning. And it wasn't because I had any fear or trepidation. It was more just because I got used to my Sunday mornings not starting till 1 p.m. But it's great to be back. I want to begin this morning in Luke, starting in chapter 18, verse 9. And it'll be up on the screens. Then Jesus told this story to some who had great confidence in their own righteousness and scorned everyone else. Two men went to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a despised tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed this prayer. I thank you, God, that I'm not like other people, cheaters, sinners, adulterers, certainly not like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give you a tenth of my income. But the tax collector stood at a distance and dared not even lift his eyes to heaven as he prayed. Instead, he beat his chest in sorrow, saying, O God, be merciful to me, for I am a sinner. I tell you, this sinner, not the Pharisee, returned home justified before God. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. O God, be merciful to me, a sinner. How many times have we prayed this prayer? How many times in the midst of self-reflection, or in the midst of a self-induced tragedy? How many times when we've been down and out, all we have left to do is call on the Lord, have we prayed this prayer? I can't tell you the number of times I've relied on those eight simple words when I'm trying to repent of sin and turn back to God. Because at their essence, these are really the only words we need. It's a simplified prayer. Doesn't rely on justification of our actions. It simply is a confession that we know we need God, and without Him, we will accomplish nothing. But what about the other prayer in this story? How many times have we prayed that one, the prayer of comparison? Maybe not as overt as the Pharisee did in this example, but if we're honest with ourselves, I'm sure there's times that we've prayed, thank you, that I'm not like them. Now, I've mentioned this before in other sermons. The them is the term I like to use as the other. We see the Pharisee comparing his righteousness or self-righteousness to others. How many times are we guilty of this too? It may not be a person that we're comparing ourselves to. It may be a way of thinking. It may be an action. And it might be unspoken. It might be just in our head. It might be subconscious. Today, we're resuming our look at racial justice issues that were prompted by the events happening in our country after the death of George Floyd in May. But to be completely honest, this conversation should have started before then. Should have started back in February with the death of Ahmaud Arbery. This is not something that a lot of us may think a lot about. Because for most of us in here, we are not persons of color, and we're not faced with these things every day on a daily basis. Pastor Carl preached three sermons in the first 3 weeks in July that opened up this topic for us and gave us a lot to consider. Specifically, that these are topics that we need to look through the mind of Christ and look at in the spirit of Christ. And if you're interested in those, if you haven't heard them, or if you want to re-listen, they can be accessed on our YouTube channel, our website, or any platform that you typically listen to your podcasts on. Now, some of it was fairly heavy stuff. So as a church, we decide to press pause on it and give ourselves time to think through all the things that were discussed during that time. And now we want to come back to it, starting today and the next 2 weeks. So today, I want to revisit the broader topic of racial justice by walking you through some of my own struggles that I've had on this issue. Now, originally, I was set to speak on this very topic back in March, before everything shut down. I'm telling you that because I want to emphasize that this has been on my mind for a while, and it's not just simply because of our national conversation that we're having right now. Originally, this was slated for our mask series, and I was going to be talking about the mask of self-righteousness, which can also be known as pride. Now, even though we're not in that series, I'm still going to be talking about that mask from a deeply personal place, talking about my own struggles through the conversations surrounding white privilege that I didn't want to recognize. I didn't want to recognize the issues that I had with it, maybe because of pride, maybe because it was an unstated feeling of self-righteousness. Now, my biggest issue with the conversation surrounding white privilege is that it assumes hard work was not the main factor in a person's success. The theory, as I see it, assumes that the level of success achieved is due to being born white, being born in the U.S., being born into a two-parent household, etc. My grandfather is a first-generation American. His parents came over on a boat from Lithuania in the early 1900s. My original last name could not be pronounced, so when my ancestors reached Ellis Island, the Port Authority workers there changed it to what it is now, Savage. My grandfather grew up in Ohio and then moved to Wilkes-Barre, where he got a job as a coal miner. Black lung killed him in 1976, a year before I was born. My dad was one of 14 kids. When he graduated high school, he enlisted in the Coast Guard in order to escape his town because there was nothing to do there but drink, be poor, and dig for coal. He spent the Vietnam War serving on the United States Coast Guard cutter Rockaway. He was stationed out of Staten Island, but he sailed the Atlantic from Newfoundland to the Bahamas. Actually, got kicked out of the Bahamas, but that's a story for another time. After his service was over, though, he went back home and began apprenticing as an electrician. My Uncle Ron, who was in the Army during Vietnam, he had moved down to Lancaster and became a police officer and wanted my dad to join him and had a job for him. My dad began working at Manor Township Police in 1972. While he was working as a police officer, he and five of his co-workers decided to go back to school. They would cover each other on the street while others studied. They would take shifts for each other while others attended class, because remember back then there was no virtual learning. You had to be in the classroom. And five of them, my dad included, earned their bachelor's degree, with the sixth one earning his associate's. At the time, there was an article in the Lancaster paper saying it was the most well-educated police department in the county. When I was growing up, I was a latchkey kid. Now, if you're unfamiliar with that term, it means that I would let myself into my house after school because both my parents worked. And to be honest, there was more than a few times where I had to break into my own house because I forgot my keys. Actually became pretty good at it. Now, both of my parents worked hard to provide a good life for me. In the summertime, I had jobs, but when I went to college, with the help of my parents, plus monies left for me by my grandparents on my mother's side, and a federal loan or two, I didn't have to work. I could just focus on school, which is exactly how my dad wanted it. After college, I came back to Lancaster and went to the police academy. Lancaster is divvied up into certain sections for police departments, and my dad did not want me to get a job in the same section where he worked. He wanted me to go out on my own. He wanted me to make a name for myself. Now, I share all of this because it was the hard work of my ancestors before me that set me up to work hard for the things that I've achieved. So when the topic of white privilege comes up, I was getting a little put off by the suggestion that anything other than hard work of my ancestors had anything to do with my success. So I used to ignore it. But then it started getting to the point where I was getting upset about it, and I couldn't ignore it anymore. I had to question, why was I getting so upset? If I didn't believe in this argument, why was it affecting me so much? Now, I understand, as a law enforcement officer, I work in an industry that is seen racist by a vocal minority. And I recognize that the criminal justice system, as it was set up as inherently racist. Yet in my 20-year career, I have never seen any overt or even subdued racism from my coworkers, the attorneys that I work alongside with, or the judges that I've appeared in front of. But I'm also not naive enough to think that there are not pockets across this country that practice overt racism. I've never had to fear being stopped while driving because of the color of my skin. But at the same time, I'll tell you that, honestly, when I used to work patrol and pulling a car over at night, I had no idea who was in that car until I walked up on it. I'm saying all this because I find myself in a paradox of how the outside world perceives me, generally speaking, but knowing internally how I treat people. That's why it's so hard for me to accept anything other than that hard work and maybe a little bit of luck is the way forward, mostly because I've never been exposed to the alternative. On September 25th, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached a sermon on the text that I read at the beginning, Luke 18. His sermon was largely in response to a jury acquitting Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam of the kidnap and murder of Emmett Till. If you're not familiar with the story of Emmett Till, he was a 14-year-old African-American boy from Chicago who in the summer of 1955 was visiting relatives in Mississippi. Till unwittingly spoke to a 21-year-old white woman named Carolyn Bryant, which was a no-no back then. Carolyn made up a large portion of her interaction with Till, which caused her husband Roy and his half-brother J.W. to seek vengeance. Roy and J.W. found Emmett at his uncle's house, kidnapped him, severely beat him, mutilated him before shooting him in the head and sinking his body in the Tallahatchie River. Now, I'm not sure what evidence was presented at trial, but an all-white jury acquitted the men. And because of the double jeopardy rule, where you can't be tried more than once for the same crime, the men had no problem admitting to what they did in a magazine interview a year later in 1956. So on a Sunday in September 1955, when Dr. King gets up to preach on Luke 18, his consternation is directed at that all-white jury, who believed that they had completed their Christian duty by acquitting the men, because Till should never have been talking to that woman. Dr. King points out that the Pharisee, in his prayer, is all about himself. I go to church. I tithe. I fast. I'm a religious man. And as Dr. King says, everything he says is centered in himself. His whole philosophy, the Pharisee's whole philosophy, is wrapped up in that one word, I. He uses the word God, but it's only as a prelude to an expression of self-praise. He first congratulates himself on the virtues of omission, all the things that he doesn't do. Then he informs heaven on the virtues of commission, all the things he does do. Dr. King goes on to say that spiritual pride is the worst of sins, because it imagines that sin can be conquered by the efforts of man. What Dr. King had to say about the Pharisee in his sermon got me thinking. In my examination of my issues with the argument of white privilege, I tended to use I a lot. I've worked hard to get where I am. I've not gotten anything from anybody. I'm responsible for my own success. The problem with I statements is that they can sometimes become pejorative, assuming that the other side of the statement is you. You need to work harder. You need to not be so sensitive. You need to get a little tougher. While preparing for this sermon, I saw something on Instagram from the author Elizabeth Gilbert, who's mostly known for her novel Eat, Pray, Love, that was helpful in articulating the things that I was feeling, but that I couldn't articulate myself. It gave me a chance to finally put into words my evolving views on this issue of white privilege as I was working through them. Gilbert says, "I used to think that my accomplishments were the result of hard work and talent, along with a bit of good luck. Now I understand that every opportunity I've ever been given in life was the direct result of generations of white privilege afforded to my ancestors and passed along to me because of our skin color. Because my family was not rich, I never thought the word privilege applied to me. I was wrong. The fact is, my people were always given the best possible chance for success in America, allowed to migrate here, to hold property, to apply for jobs, to open businesses, to get loans, to vote, hold office, to have access to education and healthcare, and to travel about the country freely in search of a better life. White privilege does not mean success was ever guaranteed to me. It merely means that the odds were always overwhelmingly stacked in my favor. And this part of the quote is really what hit home for me. White privilege doesn't mean that I haven't worked hard or don't have talent. It merely means that I was offered the best possible conditions in which my hard work and talent could blossom. And white privilege doesn't mean that my family never struggled or suffered. It merely means that whatever struggles we faced were not made more difficult by our skin color. There was a time in my life where I did not fully understand any of this, and I was wrong. Let us be humble and open, not defensive. And that last line of her quote is what I had been feeling during this whole internal struggle that I was having. I was getting defensive. I was not open to the idea that white privilege is a real thing. Daniel Hill, founding and senior pastor of River City Community Church, located in the Humboldt Park neighborhood of Chicago, he wrote a book called White Awake. And he also discusses the scripture that I spoke about earlier, Luke 18, using the one-degree rule as a metaphor to how well-intentioned Christian brothers and sisters might be dismissing their own self-righteousness. Hill writes, "In aviation, there's a principle called the one-degree rule. A tiny error in direction can make a big difference in the final destination of a flight. If you're 1 degree off for a mile, that's a 90-foot miss. And if the trip is 60 miles, the plane will miss its target by a full mile. If your direction is 1 degree off from New York to LA, you end up being 50 miles off course." Now, we don't need the 1 degree rule when identifying extreme examples of self-righteousness or pride. It doesn't take any special powers of observation or discernment to see it when it's right in front of us. But as Hill points out, what about when self-righteousness presents itself as small or seemingly insignificant? A snide remark there, a comment for humor there. Do we notice it? Do we care? When looking at this parable, Hill points out that the Pharisee had set up in his mind categories for right living. Hill writes, "As human beings, we all consistently do the same thing. We create and recreate our own categories of right living, which serve as failed attempts to prop up an established sense of self-identity. One's education level, racial background, political affiliation, commitment to a social cause, abstinence from a certain activity, adherence to a certain set of doctrines, or any combination thereof can be the criteria. And when we set up for ourselves categories of what we think is right versus what we think is wrong, then we begin to use the in-group and out-group language, or the other. We begin to look at the differences as opposed to the similarities. So how does that work itself out in my struggles surrounding the conversation of white privilege? I have worked hard for everything that I've earned. They should work harder. I don't think we need the one-degree rule to see the self-righteousness in that statement. But again, we build these categories for what we believe is right and what we believe is wrong, for living in a way that vindicates us as good people. And anything that challenges that can be a shock to our system. In explanation, Pastor Hill writes, "It's difficult to recognize the presence of something unhealthy within us if it's not overtly obvious. To survive the pressure that self-awareness creates, we then develop these defense mechanisms in relation to the contradictory acts that we are seeing." Now, revolving around the conversation of race, the bottom line is this: self-righteousness undermines healthy identity development. Are we seeing ourselves the way that we really are? How can we see ourselves without blinders on? Self-righteousness undermines our ability to dismantle the system of racism. If we can't see it, does it really exist? The cure for self-righteousness is repentance. Start small. Ask Jesus to point out in our lives categories we have set up and the best way to tear them down. In his book, Reconstructing the Gospel, Jonathan Wilson Hargrove discusses the encounter in the Gospel of Mark between Jesus and blind Bartimaeus. Now, prior to this encounter, Jesus restores the sight to another blind man. So through these interactions, Mark is trying to tell us that the gospel is about learning to see, which in its own way speaks to our most basic problem. Sin is a kind of blindness. So in Mark 10, starting in verse 46, we read, "Then they reached Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples left town, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, was sitting beside the road. When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was nearby, he began to shout, 'Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me.' 'Be quiet,' many of the crowd yelled at him. But he only shouted louder, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' When Jesus heard him, he stopped and said, 'Tell him to come here.' So they called the blind man. 'Cheer up,' they said. 'Come on, he's calling you.' Bartimaeus threw aside his coat, jumped up, and came to Jesus. 'What do you want me to do for you?' Jesus asked. 'My rabbi,' the blind man said, 'I want to see.' And Jesus said to him, 'Go, for your faith has healed you.' Instantly, the man could see, and he followed Jesus down the road." So this interaction begins with Bartimaeus shouting for Jesus, "Have mercy on me." People around Bartimaeus are telling him to be quiet, but he ignores them, knowing that this may be his only chance to regain his sight. When called, Bartimaeus throws off his coat and runs for Jesus. There, in front of the crowd, Jesus asks Bartimaeus the question that all of us need to answer, the most basic question of the human heart: what do you want? As Hargrove writes, this is the question that Jesus has been trying to get his disciples to grapple with. They've seen his power, they've believed his message, and they've dropped everything to follow him. What do you really want? Bartimaeus isn't just answering this question for himself. No. As Mark tells it, he's answering for the disciples, for the crowds, for the religious leaders, and for all of us who are blind even though we don't know that we cannot see. What do you want? Jesus asks. Rabbi, I want to see. So the question you need to ask yourself is, do you want to see? I can go on for an entire series about how the church has been complacent at best and complicit at worst regarding race relations in this country's history. And while my inner turmoil regarding race and white privilege are the basis for this sermon, it's also something that's deeply personal to me. Maybe it's personal to you as well. Maybe it's something else. But the question remains the same. Do you want to see? Do you want to examine the categories that you've built around what your perception of right and wrong is? Do you want to identify the barriers that you may have constructed that separates you from the other? Do you want to see? Are you willing to see and lament the fact that for most people of color, all of the struggles and challenges they face, which are struggles and challenges we face too, are made more difficult by the color of their skin? Do you want to lament the fact that the road that they're traveling is uphill and is harder to climb because their skin's a darker shade than ours? Are you willing to see that to this day it's still more challenging and more difficult for people of color to relocate, to hold property, to apply for jobs, to open businesses, to get loans, to vote, to hold office, to have access to education, access to health care, and to travel about the country freely in search of a better life? I believe that the one degree rule is a real thing. And I think it's important for us to take a deep dive into our own worldview and belief system to flush out the areas where we may be off a degree here, off a degree there. The truth is that our very nature is to embrace an us versus them mentality. And if it's overt, it's easily recognizable. But I would argue more often than not, it's not overt. And I would also add that this very nature, this us versus them, is the nature that Jesus is trying to get us to leave behind. Like Bartimaeus, though, we have to want to see. Take the opportunity this week for some deep self-reflection. Take the opportunity this week to take a hard look at the beliefs that and where you may feel justified. Take them to God. Ask Him to help you see. The mask of self-righteousness is a difficult one to identify. It's difficult to take off, mostly because it's internal. The reason the tax collector was justified is because he came before God with no assumptions. He came before God with no justifications. He simply poured himself out and asked for mercy because he was a sinner. Let us do the same.